Hello, everyone. My name is Elijah David, Minister of the 12th Hour Apostolic Shabbatarian Congregation, now on top of the 12th Hour, in the Liberty Hill, Texas. Today is July 25, 2014, or is the 29th day of the 4th lunar month, 2018. We will start our first service today with a song entitled, It Is Morning in My Heart. All the darkness of the night has passed away. It is morning in my heart. I am living in the sunlight of the day. It is morning in my heart. It is morning, it is morning in my heart. That's what made the gloomy shadows all depart. Songs of gladness now I see, for since Yahshua is my King. It is morning, it is morning in my heart. I can hear the songbirds singing their refrain. It is morning in my heart. And I know that life for me begins again. It is morning in my heart. It is morning, it is morning in my heart. Joshua made the gloomy shadows all depart. Songs of gladness now I sing, for since Joshua is my King. It is morning, it is morning in my heart. Yahshua has made the world a paradise to me. It is morning in my heart. Every duty in the light of love I see. It is morning in my heart. It is morning, it is morning in my heart. Joshua made the gloomy shadows all depart. Sound of gladness now I sing, for since Joshua is my King. It is morning in my heart. Yahshua has come to dwell with me forevermore. It is morning in my heart. I shall sing it when I reach the other shore. It is morning in my heart. It is morning, it is morning in my heart. Yahshua made the gloomy shadows all depart. Sound of gladness now I sing, for since Yahshua is my King. It is morning, it is morning in my heart.
Part 4, Antiphon Elijah restores everything. We're on page 12 of the White House Recruiter by Vita Hala. Let's turn to Kings, 1 Kings chapter 17, actually, and let's read the whole chapter. It says, and Elijah the Tishbite, who was of the inhabitants of Gilead, said unto Ahab, as Yahweh Elohim of the Israel liveth, before whom I stand, there shall not be dew nor rain these years, but according to my word. Now, I represented Elijah at Kermit, Texas, in 2002. And Brother Johnson represented Ahab the Tishbite. Now, we're having a repeat of this here, Elijah engaging the antitypical Ahab from Gilead. Elijah came from Gilead. And he went to Carmel, and he contested the king of Israel, Ahab, concerning true prophets and false prophets. And it took Elijah 3.5 years to prove his point and to get the situation set up to where he could have this confrontation with the false prophets in Israel. Today, we had to get this confrontation set up again in the Antitype to have this confrontation with Israel again today. That's the Adventist Church and to deliver the 144,000, the remnant. So it says in 1 Kings 17:2, and the word of Yahweh came unto him, saying, get thee hence and turn thee eastward and hide thyself by the brook Cherith, that is before Jordan. And it shall be that thou shalt drink of the brook, and I have commanded the ravens to feed thee there. So he went, and did according unto the word of Yahweh, for he went and dwelt by the brook Cherith, that is before Jordan. And the ravens brought him bread and flesh in the morning, and bread and flesh in the evening, and he drank of the brook. And it came to pass after a while that the brook dried up, because there had been no rain in the land. And the word of Yahweh came unto him, saying, arise, get thee to Zarephath, which belongeth unto Zidon, and dwell there. Behold, I have commanded a widow woman there to sustain thee. So he arose and went to Zarephath, and when he came unto the gate of the city, behold, the widow woman was there gathering of the sticks, and he called unto her and said, fetch me, I pray thee, a little water in a vessel, that I may drink. And as she was going to fetch it, he called to her and said, bring me, I pray thee, a morsel of bread in thine hand. And she said, as the Yahweh the Elohim liveth, I have not a cake, but an handful of meal in a barrel, and a little oil in a cruse. And behold, I am getting two sticks that I may go in and dress it for me and my son, that we may eat it and die. And Elijah said unto her, fear not. Go and do as thou hast said, but make me thereof a little cake first, and bring it unto me. And after, make for thee and for thy son. For thus saith Yahweh, Elohim of Israel, a barrel of meal shall not waste, neither shall the cruse of oil fail, until the day that the Yahweh sendeth rain upon the earth. And she went and did according unto the saying of Elijah. And she and he and her house did eat many days. And the barrel of the meal wasted not, neither did the cruse of oil fail, according unto the word of Yahweh which she spake by the Elijah. And it came to pass after these sayings that the son of the woman, the mistress of the house, fell sick, and his sickness was so sore that there was no breath left in him. And she said unto Elijah, what have I to do with thee, O thou man of Elohim? Art thou come unto me to call my sin to remembrance, and to slay my son? And he said unto her, give me thy son. And he took him out of her bosom, and carried him up into a loft, where he abode, and laid him upon his own bed. And he cried unto Yahweh, and said, O Yahweh, my Elohim, hast thou also brought evil upon the widow, with whom I sojourned by slaying her son? And he stretched himself upon the child 3 times, and cried unto Yahweh, and said, O Yahweh, my Elohim, I pray thee, let this child's soul come into him again. And Yahweh heard the voice of Elijah, and the soul of the child came into him again, and he revived. And Elijah took the child, and brought him down out of the chamber into the house, and delivered him unto his mother. And Elijah said, see, thy son liveth. And the woman said unto Elijah, now by this I know that thou art a man of Elohim, and that the word of Yahweh in thy mouth is of the truth. Okay, I rest my case. Yahweh is calling upon this antitypical Elijah that's going to be able to do the same thing that the Elijah the Tishbite did. Going to be able to bring judgments upon Israel and the world, and he's going to be able to restore life unto those that are worthy of it, those that serve Yahweh with their whole heart, those that are willing to do whatever he tells them to do, Elijah will have the power to pronounce whatever upon them, blessings and curses. And he's preparing our home here to be able to have this power and influence. And Yahweh will bless us according to our putting forth the effort to become 100% restored. And that's what we're doing right now is in our series is and typically Elijah restores everything. And so we're in the process now of making another step in faith forward. And let us now pick up on our main theme, taken from the White House Recruiter Room, page 12. We'll do just a little review for what we did yesterday. V.T. Holliff is addressing to us Seventh-day Adventists. He's including himself as a Seventh-day Adventist, and indeed that's all he was. In particular, the meaning of what we see around us should be a window clear, making manifest that the time has now come for every church member to engage in the proclaiming of the three angels' messages. There are moreover thousands of pastoral posts now waiting to be filled by both graduates and undergraduates of Seventh-day Adventist Ministerial Colleges. So let no one with such qualification any longer be found either standing idle or engaging in the secular occupation while the Yahshua's work languishes and waits. If that be the case in V.T. Holliff's day, between 1930 and 1970, how much more should it be in our day? As Brother Johnson was called to succeed V.T. Holliff and to engage in the work more fully by the continuing on the same message that V.T. Holliff was putting forth. And that was admonishing the Adventists to come on up a step higher. Well, you can only bring people up as high as you are. And so, being fresh out of the Adventist Church in 1970, that would be Verlis Johnson and myself. We were just fresh out of the Adventist Church. So, what I'm saying is, as V.T. Holliff was saying at that time, he says, at this very hour, millions without hope are waiting and are withering away, perishing in the fields of the sin and on the fields of battle, because no one has won them unto the Yahshua with the everlasting gospel. Now this is interesting. The everlasting gospel. You know, this everlasting gospel has been ongoing ever since Yahweh made the everlasting covenant with Adam after he sinned. The everlasting gospel was put in operation right at the Garden Gate, been renewed unto Yahweh's servants down through the ages of time. Okay. It says, who will go for them? Who has the vision, the heart, and the will to go out in the rescue of the humanity for the Yahshua? For all college graduates, undergraduates, and Bible workers who have the ability and the will to equip themselves for the work, both the opportunity for the service and the means for the upkeep and traveling expenses are ready and waiting. Hence, there are no grounds for, and I pray thee have an excuse, Luke 4:18. For the inspiration's appeal, arise and shine, is unto every soul. Will you not respond, brethren? Will you not earnestly pray for yourself and for other laborers to help gather in the precious golden grain, or will you fail in the unforgiving responsibility and forfeit this most lofty privilege? For the issue is of the greatest gravity. Yahshua foreknew it would be, and in the supreme concern he projected it in the crowning lesson of his parable of the vineyard. Now that time has come to the last parabolical hour. He has set the parable ablaze with the light. To be progressive as the truth itself is, let us look deeper into the parable now while the light of the Elohim is shining on the parable of Matthew 20 concerning the five groups of laborers that are brought to view in that chapter. It says, "For the kingdom of heaven is like unto a man that is an householder, which went out early in the morning to hire laborers into his vineyard. And when he had agreed with the laborers for a penny a day, he sent them into his vineyard. And he went out about the third hour, and saw others standing idle in the marketplace, and said unto them, Go ye also into the vineyard, and whatsoever is right I will give you. And they went their way. Again he went out about the sixth and the ninth hour, and did likewise. And about the 11th hour, he went out and found others standing idle, and says unto them, Why stand ye here all the day idle? They say unto him, Because no man hath hired us." Now keep in mind, at the fulfillment of this 11th hour, with the fifth group of laborers, the house of David, they were in the marketplace looking for a hire. They were wanting to be hired. They were in the marketplace. The marketplace was Gilead Center, Kermit, Texas. And can you imagine? Those laborers showed up in the marketplace and been standing there in the marketplace during the 11th hour. The 11th hour began in 1970. And these laborers have come and gone. And they have come and gone in that 11th hour. They just come to that marketplace looking for hire. And when they didn't get hired, they moved on. A lot of them just went ahead and moved on. Well, isn't that the truth? When you go down to the marketplace and you're looking for work, and if somebody comes along that needs some help, he'll hire you, more than likely. But if he doesn't come to the marketplace, if no one comes, but then you just stand there idle all the day long until somebody comes to offer you some work. So, those laborers have been standing in that marketplace the whole 11th hour and hadn't been hired. What's going on here? Well, the one in charge of the vineyard, Brother Stevie Johnson, never had any production over the years. So therefore, he didn't have any need to hire anybody. He didn't have any production. He never produced one fruit. His 33 years that I was with him, he never brought forth and produced one fruit that went out there and worked in the vineyard. So now you understand why they were standing idle then, because the owner of the vineyard wasn't producing any fruit to begin with. So he didn't have no need. In other words, he had a drought going on. He had Elijah's drought going on and didn't know it. So if you're not producing, you don't have no need to hire nobody. Okay, let's continue on. How can we know for a certainty in which hour we find ourselves and if our own call to service has come? We can know only by the establishment of the time in which the last parabolic hour expired. Okay. So the last parabolic hour in V.T. Hodder's day was the one that was called at the third hour, William Miller. So that's what V.T. Hodder's referring to. He said, well, we'll have to go back to 1844 when that last parabolic hour expired. And so that would be William Miller. But now V.T. Hodder believes that he's the fifth group of laborers, and he believes that he's answering the 11th hour call, and he's already shown in the White House recruiter further on down where the Adventists answered the fourth call, and the Millerites answered the third call. So now he would have to determine when the Adventist call expired, the fourth group of laborers, Matthew 20, verse 5. call it the ninth hour. So Vichy Hall thinks that he has pinpointed the time when that last hour expired. And he's saying that the fourth group of laborers is setting the evidence that their time expired in 1930. I can tell you right now what he's getting at. So he believes he's a fifth hour group, and so now he thinks he's got this parable all pinned down. And all the time, he's part of the fourth group of laborers. And the fourth group of laborers have their period through the 10th and 11th parabolic hour. Vichy Hall is in the 10th parabolic hour, and he's trying to show where the Adventist time had expired in 1930 as the fourth group of laborers. That's what he's saying here. How can we know of a certainty in which hour we find ourselves, and if our own call to service has come? So he's going to try to show the Shepherd Rod people, his people, that their time had come in 1930 to succeed the Advent, and that they were the fifth group of laborers. Okay? Then he goes on to say, we can know only by establishing the time in which the last parabolic hour expires. Well, he being part of the fourth group of laborers, the last parabolic hour for him then that expired would be the third one. And that was called, Millerites called it the sixth hour in 1833, and their time ended in 1844. So now to get the parable accurate and make it correct, this is the way he would have to taught that, but he'd had to have inspiration on that, in which he didn't. That is gone. And to do this, we must first establish the time of the first call for the servant, then the turn, in turn, and the time of each successive call, culminating with the last. First, though, pursuant to this end, we must bring into the focus of the parable a significant point. Number one, the householder, as every Bible student knows, is the Yeshua himself. I've been a little confused on this before. I've taught it both ways, that Yahweh the Father is the householder. But now I'm more convinced that Yeshua is the householder himself. Because he went out when he came on the scene for the second call. Number two, the laborers are his servants. And when Yeshua came on the scene and answered the second call with the disciples, he was the one that went out and hired the 12 disciples to work with him for 3.5 years. So Yeshua was a householder then. And if he was a householder then, he was a householder coming out of Egypt with the first group of laborers. Because if, as Paul said, he was that rock in the cloud. Yeshua was that rock in the cloud that was over Israel when they came out of Egypt. So he was a householder there. He came on the scene and at the cross as a living householder. So how much more proof do we need? Number three, it says the penny is the reward. Number four, his vineyard is the place where they are to labor. And it says in Isaiah 5:7, the vineyard of the Yahweh of hosts is the house of Israel, or the Yahshua of hosts is the house of Israel. Number five, the day is parabolical, representing a period of time which is illuminated by some great light. And number six, the period of labor is both preceded and succeeded by a night. Else there could be no early and no late part of the day. Number seven, the householder hires laborers at five different times. Number eight, there are 4 3-hour periods. Number nine, in each of the first three periods, only one group is hired. Okay, so now, that would be Moses, the children of Israel. That would be the first group. Second group would be Yahshua and the disciples. And the third group would be the Millerites. But in the fourth group, that was hired at the ninth hour and the last period of 3 hours, two groups are hired. Okay. So now, he said in this fourth group, he said two groups are hired. Okay. So, what groups are those? In that fourth group, the Adventists were the fourth group. But he said in that fourth group, two groups of laborers were hired. Two groups. The other thing is, William Miller and his people were hired as a third group of laborers in 1833, but they were in the same verse of Matthew 20, verse 5, where the fourth group of laborers showed up. So V.T. Hollis, because they were sixth and ninth hour laborers were found in that Matthew 20, verse 5, he said those two groups were hired, and they represented the fourth group of laborers. Well, what happened to the third group of laborers then? See, V.T. Hollis skipped over the third group of laborers. He made the third group of laborers, Millerized, part of the fourth group of laborers as hired, the two groups as hired in the fourth three-hour segment of time. But let me correct this for you now. No, there were two groups of laborers hired. All right enough. Of the fourth group. And that was the Adventist, Seventh-day Adventist, Basin, and the Shepherd's Rod, the Davidian Seventh-day Adventist, Carmel, and Gilead. There were your two groups of laborers as hired in the fourth hour, or the fourth group, hired at the ninth hour. Now, this is the first time we've ever straightened this parable out on that. And I've got to go and upgrade that in my book. Number 11, the agreement for a penny a day is made only with the first group. Number 12, the other groups are to receive whatsoever is right. Which is number 12. The 13, at the day's end, all are given the same pay, a penny, even though the last worked only an hour. 14, the first were paid last, and the last first. Let's do a little review of what I just read. Now, let's go back over this number 1 about the householder. As every Bible student knows, is Yahshua himself. Number 2, the laborers are his servants. Number 3, the penny is the reward. Number 4, his vineyard is the place where they are to labor. Isaiah 5, 7, vineyard of the Yahshua of hosts is the house of Israel. So they're the labor in the house of Israel. The day is parabolical, representing a period of the time, which is illuminated by some great light. Number 6, the period of labor is both preceded and succeeded by a night. Yes, there could be no early and no late part of the day. Number 7, the householder hires laborers at 5 different times. Number 8, there are 4 three-hour periods. Okay, 4 three-hour periods. So when you count 4 three-hour periods, you have 12 hours. Yahshua says in John 11, 9, are there not 12 hours in the day? All right. So in the first 3-hour period, only one group is hired. Okay. In the first 3-hour period, only one group is hired. Number 10. In the fourth and last period of the 3 hours, two groups are hired. Right? So in that last segment of time, of the 3-hour period of time, there are two groups of laborers hired. And that would be between the ninth hour and the 12th hour. You'd have to count 3 hours between the ninth hour and the 12th hour. So let's count them. 10, 11, and 12. So those 3 hours makes up that fourth group, that fourth segment of time, was the 10th, and the 11th, and the 12th. Okay. Now the agreements for a penny a day is made only with the first group. And number 12, the other groups are to receive whatsoever is right. And number 13, at the day's end, all are given the same pay, a penny. Even though the last work only an hour, the last one. And the last one was the fifth group of laborers that was hired for the 12th hour. Matthew 20, verse 6. And the other group of laborers that's hired But it's your fourth group, the Adventists, hired at the ninth hour, at the end of the ninth hour in 1844. So the two groups of laborers that made up the last 3 hour time period, then would be the Adventists and the Mount Zion at the 12th hour, the House of David. So, P.T. Harlef, he's showing where the Millerites and the Adventists represented these two groups of laborers. That was called in Matthew 20, verse 5, at the sixth and the ninth hour. Not so. Because when you count between 6 and 9, you count 7, 8, and 9. You have to count the ninth hour to go with the 3 hours between 6 and 9. So that's the reason why these labors are called at the end of those hours. Okay? So now, we've straightened out the last, I hope, the last flaw that we were doing in the parable of Matthew 20. We've always taught that the sixth and the ninth hour call, the Millerites and the Adventists, the first day Adventists, Millerites, and the seventh day Adventists, the Adventists, were the two groups of his call to work in that last 3 hour period. But not so. The Adventists, the fourth group of laborers, as called in 1844, and the 11th hour call laborers to work in the 12th hour, the House of David, that's the two groups of laborers that filled out that last 3 hour period. So, what are we looking at? We're looking at a little bit clearer explanation of the four 3 hour periods. The last 3 hour period is between 9 and 12. So you count between 9 and actually the end of the 12th hour. You have to include 10, 11, and 12. You have to include the 12 in that. Okay. Now to find out in which hour we are told, B.T. Harlef is talking now, Now to find out in which hour we are told, go ye also, we must here at the outset of this go to work steady, determine where in the time the parable begins and where it ends. To gain this vital knowledge is simply to reckon with the sequentially amplifying fact that the parabolical night which precedes the parabolical day must necessarily be the period before the spiritual light of the world. For the Bible came up before the light of the Scriptures, the written word of the Elohim began to shine forth into the hearts of men. For back there it must be remembered, the will of Elohim was transmitted not by the Bible but orally from father to son. Just as the light of the sun at night is transmitted in the earth by the moon, rather than directly by the sun itself. For this reason, it has come to be regarded as a time of the oral tradition. But the day of the labor obviously represents the period in which the light of the world, the Bible itself, lightens man's path. Thus it is that in his parable, the Master, the Yahshua the Vineyard, regards the Old and New Testament dispensation as the only day period of all probationary time in which he goes to the marketplace at the 5 consecutive times to hire servants to work in his vineyard. Finally, the night following the day can only represent the period after the gospel work is finished. Okay, after probation for the man's salvation is closed. So probation can't close until after the 12th hour is over. Then as the light of the world, the word of the Elohim, sinks beyond the horizon of the day, darkness covers the earth and gross darkness of people. Isaiah 60 verse 2. It is a time which finds the destiny of every being forever fixed. Then follows the Yahshua's irrevocable finality. He that is unjust, let him be unjust still, and he which is filthy, let him be filthy still, and he that is righteous, let him be righteous still, and he that is holy, let him be holy still. Revelation 22:11. It is the time when men shall run to and fro to seek the word of Yahweh, and shall not find it. Amos 8:12. The time when the unmindful of the Master's call and the impenitent of the sin realize and cry out in the frenzied and agonized despair. The harvest is past, and the summer is ended, and we are now saved. Jeremiah 8:20. For the truth has now become clear that the parable divides the time of the salvation into two equal parts of the 12 symbolical hours. Each the period before the Bible, the night, and the period during the Bible, the day, lending additional force unto the fact that the parable thus divide time. Thy sure declares, are there not 12 hours in the day? If any man walk in the day, he stumbleth not, because he seeth the light of this world. John 11:9. Proceeding now, we come to another point of the special significance. The first four groups are heard at the consecutive intervals, three parabolic hours apart. Whereas the fifth, the last group, the one heard at the end of the 11th hour in 2002, came only 2 instead of 3 hours later than the fourth group. And thus only one parabolic hour before the day's end, shortly before probation closes. So there you have it. You have the Adventist heard at the beginning of that 3 hour, the last 3 hour period, which was your fourth period. They were heard at the beginning of it in 1844. The 11th hour, end of the 11th hour, was heard at the end of the 11th hour. So the Adventists, the fourth group of laborers, worked in the 10th and the 11th parabolic hour, from 1844 up to 2003. And then that fifth group took up its work in 2003 to succeed the fourth group, and that's found in Matthew 20, verse 6. Okay. This two-hour period, from the 9th hour until the 11th hour, is a singularity which comes as a climatic exception to the master pattern of the sequential and regular three-hour intervals between the call. It obviously reveals that the last call comes unexpectedly and surprisingly within the period of the ninth hour group. Okay. Hence, there are only two parabolical hours for the one group, that's the fourth group, for the Adventist, and only one parabolical group for the fifth group, call it the end of the 11th hour, Matthew 20, verse 6, for the house of David, for the everlasting kingdom of heaven occupies the 12th hour. Heaven has come down and sit up and occupies the 12th parabolical hour, the kingdom of heaven here on earth. Hallett did not know that when he wrote this. To determine the identity of the laborers participating in each of the five different calls, we necessarily begin our quest with the servants of the first call. We have already seen that it is in the Bible that the spiritual light of the world that makes the parabolical day. For we all know, moreover, that the Bible arrived with the Exodus movement. Also, since the arrival, the Yahshua never bargained, as it were, with another people, and that they were the only ones unto whom he ever committed the ceremonial covenant and all the rewards and promises. Inescapably, therefore, the first group of the parable, those who went to labor early in the morning as at the rising of the spiritual light, the Bible, and with whom the bargain was made to receive a penny a day, were the ancient Israel as they were going out of Egypt the time of which was early in the parabolical day, and the concord the spirit of the prophecy declared. For the Jews had been first called into the Yahshua's vineyard. Okay, that's taken from Christologic Lessons, page 400 by Ellen G. White. At that early hour, as Elohim began to indict the scriptures, as the light that lightens the hearts of men began to rise, he remembered his covenant forever, the word which he commanded to a thousand generations, which covenant he made with Abraham, and his oath unto Isaac, and confirmed the same unto Jacob for a law, and unto Israel for an everlasting covenant. Psalms 105, verse 8 to 10. Having thus, by the first call for the servants, solidly established the time in which the parabolical go-to-work call started, we are now to ascertain the call time and work period of the servants of the second call. The second group, those sent at the third parabolical hour, must necessarily be the ones who were called to the work next, and they were the early Christians, significantly enough too. The Yahshua was crucified at the third hour of the day, Mark 15:25, and likewise Pentecost came at the third hour of the day, Acts 2:15. Another point of significance of which we should take note is the fact that the message borne by these first two groups, by the ancient Israel and by the early Christians, were not of a reformatory nature. They were not old forgotten truths in the process of the revival and restoration. Rather, each was a new revelation, meet in the due season, present truth, specifically adapted fully to meet the needs of the people in their respective time. The former group were inspired and commissioned to teach and practice the truths of salvation as embodied in the ceremonial system. The latter group were inspired and commissioned to teach and practice the same immutable truths in their advanced from the typical to the antitypical representation, from the mainstream in the earthly tabernacle to the ministration in the heavenly one. That is, from the sacrifice of a lamb of the flock to the sacrifice of Yahshua himself, the lamb of the Elohim. Thus, the latter group taught the old truths in a new and an original light, in the light of the gospel, that Yahshua was crucified for the remission of sin, resurrected in triumph over sin and death, and ascended to make atonement and reconciliation for the penitent sinner, not in an earthly but in an heavenly tabernacle. Since the messages of the first two groups, the one carried by the Exodus movement and the other carried by the Christians, were each in their respective times fresh from the glory, that fact logically establishes itself as a divine precedent and pattern for all the messages of the parable. Accordingly, each of the three remaining groups must likewise be entrusted with the message of the new and distinctive revelation of the meat and a due season, truth adapted especially and fully to meet the needs of the Elohim people at the time then present. Therefore, we need only to trace down through the annals of church history the unfolding of the scroll till we come upon a newly and originally revealed and proclaimed truth subsequent unto the message of the first advent of Yahshua. It must point out the servants of the third call. For the Protestant Reformation, being purely an endeavor to restore old, downtrodden truths, and not to reveal new, advanced ones, had no new message of its own, nothing that had not already been taught in the times past. It therefore follows that the third group and message must be sought during the years following the Reformation. The only revelation of the new prophetic truth subsequent unto the Reformation is the announcement of the year in which was to begin the work of the cleansing of the sanctuary, primarily in behalf of the dead, based on the Daniel 8:14, but not then fully understood. As its announcement was made by the first day Adventists, it necessarily followed that they were the third group of the service with a new and distinctive message, and that, as is well known, they started proclaiming it in the year of 1833, announcing that the cleansing of the sanctuary was to commence in the year of 1844. Thus, in 1833, the clock of the parabolical time struck the hour of six. The statement, again, he went out about the sixth and ninth hour and did likewise. In speaking of the two calls, not singly, as in the cases of the two preceding calls, but conjointly, it shows that the sixth hour message and servants were to be closely related to and associated with the message and with the servants of the fourth call. So it was that the sixth hour group and message, that of the first day Adventists, the Millerites, 1833, and the ninth hour group, the Seventh Day Adventists, 1844, fused into one because the message of the former was in itself divinely designed to bring the message of the latter to life. So, the third group of laborers, the Millerites, joined with the fourth group of laborers, the Adventists, and so the Millerites occupied the 7th, 8th, and 9th parabolic hour, and the fourth group that they were associated with, the Adventists, occupied the 10th and the 11th parabolic hour. So those two groups of laborers, the third and the fourth group of laborers, occupied 5 parabolic hours, 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, and the 11th. Whereas the last group, the 11th hour group, that was called in that last 3-hour segment with the Adventists, is the house of David in the 12th parabolic hour. Now that's what B.T. Hollis should have explained more clearly had he had understood fully what he was talking about. So let's continue on. So it was that the 6th hour group and message, that of the first day Adventists, and the 9th hour group and message, that of the Seventh Day Adventists, fused into one because the message of the former was in itself divinely designed to bring the message of the latter to light. Moreover, as soon as the terminus of the prophetic 2300 days, Daniel 8:14, was reached in October 1844, just then Daniel 8:14, Daniel 7:9 and 10, and Daniel 12:10 and 12, along with Revelation 14:6 and 7, the first angel's message in its primary phase were first proclaimed by the Seventh-day Adventist saying with a loud voice, "Fear Elohim and give glory unto him, for the hour of his judgment is come." And verse 10 that made heaven and earth and the sea and the fountains of water, Revelation 14:7. Thus, the Seventh-day Adventists in 1844 began to proclaim what they termed as the investigative judgment of the dead, which in the scriptural terms is the casting out of those who have not the wedding garment on, Matthew 22:11-13, the shutting out of the 5 foolish virgins, Matthew 25:10, the dividing of the sheep and the goats, Matthew 25:32-33, the separating of the bad fish from the good fish, Matthew 13:48. Each of these among the dead, synonymously, they rightly understood it to be the antiphonal day of the atonement, the day in which are removed from the books in the heaven the names of those who in the closing of their last career failed to attain eligibility to come up in the first resurrection, in the resurrection of the Holy One. See Matthew 20:5-6. All these aspects are comprehended in the words, "Then shall the sanctuary be cleansed," Daniel 8:14. As the cleansing of the sanctuary in the behalf of the dead is necessarily purely a book transaction, that is the reason for its taking place only in the heavenly sanctuary. Hence, the names of the ineligible for the first resurrection are screened from the names of the eligible ones, as heaven's books deal with all aspects of the life, as evident from Psalms 56:8, 69:28, and Psalms 139:16, Daniel 12:1, Malachi 3:16, Philippians 4:3, Revelation 3:5, etc. Hence, prophecy revealed that when the judgment was set, the books were opened, Daniel 7:10. As the judgment, our message is of a character and importance singular in all church history, also as it is the only prophetic message to sound subsequent to the sixth-hour message. Nothing can be more certain than that as it went forth in 1844 for the first time, Elohim's parabolic timepiece peaced and struck nine. Consequently, the ninth-hour group in the parable can be none other than the Seventh-day Adventists who were then on foot to proclaim that the judgment was set and the books were opened, Daniel 7:10, and that anyone who then, during the antipodal day of the atonement for the dead, should be found among the dead with his sins unconfessed, his soul not afflicted, and without the wedding garment on, would be cut off from among his people. Matthew 22:11-13, Leviticus 23:29. In brief, the message declared that the separation in the congregation of the dead had then begun. Okay, now I want to say this, that you also had the teaching about the second phase, the judgment of the living, that would succeed the judgment of the dead. But what is being described here by V.T. Hardiff is actually the judgment for the living. Because the judgment for the dead was a silent judgment that took place in the heaven for 158 years, 1844, 2002, 2003. And let us continue now. Now that for the first time the parable is ablaze with the light, none but the eye that is hopelessly gone out in the dungeon darkness and fail to see distinctly that the message with which we Seventh-day Adventists were entrusted with in 1844 at the end of the ninth parabolic hour, 1844 is not the 11th parabolic hour, not the message of the judgment of the living, but rather only of the judgment of the dead. Now here V.T. Hardiff is trying to make it clear that he represents this 11th hour group. Let's call it the 11th hour, in 1930. So, you see, with his misunderstanding of where he was in the stream of time, naturally he would teach the message the way he did. That we're the last message, we're the last hour, and I'm the last prophet, and it would have to be Elijah, had already come. So he was trapped in a capsule there. And he had to preach his message exactly the way William Miller had to preach his message. He had to preach it with a little bit of covering over the full meaning of the prophecy and the parable. Okay, as the prospective servants of Elohim let each hear at this focal point of the parable pause a moment, the fixed firmly in the mind is all-important lesson as brought out in the following illustration. For the next decisive point of the truth is that the judgment of the dead was to be proclaimed unto many people and nations and tongues and kings, Revelation 10:11. Marks the word many. It never means all and never means every. Since this verse of the scripture foretells the expansion of the ninth hour group and message, it will highly repay each one carefully to examine what the Revelation 10:11 says on the subject. You dare not add to the word nor subtract from it. then compare it with the scriptures to follow, foretelling the expansion of the 11th hour group, and message that you will have the whole truth and the reference unto the finishing of the work. Okay. Now that the time has finally come for the Yahshua to recruit his 11th hour servants. Now Vityalda was saying, now the time has finally come here in 1951 when he wrote his tract. He says, finally come now. Remember now, a year before, he was calling for the Adventists and telling them that the time has finally come to give up the 144,000, that it's time to move on with them, that we were in the 11th and last hour. And now he's telling these people here in 51, after the disappointment in 1950, now he's telling them in this next tract, he says, now that the time has finally come for the Yahweh to recruit his 11th hour servant, this precious parable is unfolding, and for the first time it is plainly seen that whereas the judgment of the dead was to be proclaimed to many nations and people, the judgment of the living is to be proclaimed unto all nations and unto every people on earth. Here is what inspiration itself says. It says, and I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach unto them that dwell on the earth, and unto every nation and kindred and tongue and people, saying with a loud voice, fear Elohim and give glory unto him, for the hour of his judgment is come. And he worshiped him that made the heaven and the earth and the sea and the fountains of the waters. Revelation 14:6. That the servants at the end of the 11th hour, the house of David, the antitypical Elijah, David in charge of it, Malachi 4:5, who escaped out of the 11th hour, out of the Adventist church, out of his headwaters at Gilead Center, Kermit, Texas, who are not cut off, Leviticus 23:29, while the house of Elohim is being judged, 1 Peter 4:17, the event which signalizes the commencement of the judgment of the living worldwide are to be sent unto all nations for the inspiration of test through the prophet Isaiah, for behold, the Yahshua will come with the fire, and with his chariots like a whirlwind to render his anger with the fury, and his rebuke with the flames of the fire. For by the fire and by his sword will the Yahshua plead with all flesh, and the slain of the Yahshua shall be many, and I will set a sign among them, and I will send those that escape of them unto the nation, unto Tarshish, Pul, and Lud, that draw the bow, the Tubal, and Avan, and unto the isles afar off that have not heard my fame and seen my glory. And they shall declare my glory among the Gentiles, and they shall bring all your brethren for an offering unto the Yahshua, or the Yahweh, out of all nations, upon horses and in chariots, and in litters, upon mules, upon swift beasts, to my holy mountain, Jerusalem, saith the Yahshua. As the children of Israel bring an offering in a clean vessel into the house of the Yahweh, Isaiah 6:15, 16:19, and 20. This brings the close last day of this hour contest with the 11th hour colonist. Number 11, click on our audio archive. We're going to close this service now with a song entitled, The Old Rugged Cross. On a hill far away stood an old rugged cross, the emblem of suffering and shame. And I love that old cross for the dearest and best, for a world of lost sinners rush line. So I'll cherish the old rugged crown till my trophies at last are laid down. I will cling to the old rugged crown and exchange it someday for a crown. Oh, that old rugged cross, so despised by the world, that's a wondrous attraction for me. For the dear Lamb of Yah lift his glory above, to bear it to the Calvary. So I'll cherish the old rugged crown, till my trophies at last I lay down. I will cling to the old rugged crown, and exchange it someday for a crown. And the old rugged crown, stained with blood so divine, a wondrous beauty I see. For 'twas on that old cross Yahshua suffered and died, to pardon and sanctify me. So I'll cherish the old rugged cross, till my trophies at last I lay down. I will cling to the old rugged crown, and exchange it someday for a crown. To the old rugged cross I will ever be true, its shame and reproach gladly bear. Then he called me one day to my home far away, where his glory forever I'll share. So I'll cherish the old rugged crown, till my trophies at last I lay down. I will cling to the old rugged